Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, a trip into the mixed wood forest near Grand Prairie sheds some light on experimental logging methods and the biodiversity of the species living there. Partners in the project include Ainsworth Lumber and the Alberta Research Council. And stepping back in time, Martin Pates recalls the life of R.B. Miller, the university researcher who set up Alberta's first biological research station at Gorge Creek. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. To the casual listener, this may simply sound like some nice bird singing in the forest. But to the trained ear of an avian ecologist, this is the calling card of a particular cohort of birds that reside in an old-growth aspen stand. It's 120 years old with very little conifer understory. And to the harvest planner of a logging company, it's the sign of a new way of doing business. Fred Rattersma is the planning superintendent with Ainsworth Lumber Company at Grand Prairie. Ainsworth is a quota holder that harvests aspen to make oriented strand board. Fred and I are standing in a specially harvested cut block that's part of a research project with the Alberta Research Council.
Basically, Ainsworth is harvesting pure deciduous stands. However, there's a great deal of timber that is a predominant aspen stand with an understory of conifer. And these stands will not be harvested until the conifer has come of age in possibly 60 years. By that time, the aspen canopy will have, a lot of it will have fallen down naturally, and we're trying to gather that volume up now, possibly, if we can. However, it's not in our land base. We're experimenting right now to see if the potential is there to harvest it. So with the Mixedwood Stand Biodiversity Project, we are looking at the wildlife values, or the ecological values that are in the stand at present. We're looking at harvesting the stands in an understory protection fashion, and then we'd like to find out what values remain in the stand after the harvesting has been completed. And we have control blocks, and we have the blocks that we have harvested in. So Ainsworth's interest lies in finding out what the differences are ecologically within those blocks, and can the blocks that have been harvested, will they still maintain ecological values?
What would be an economic perspective on this?
An economic perspective is that it does cost a little bit more to harvest a stand such as this, but there is less disturbance. And basically the silvicultural costs, which are to tree plant and manage a stand again, are very limited. So there could be an offset there.
What's different about harvesting this way compared to the usual way of doing it?
The usual way is a feller buncher will enter an area and will remove every standing tree. However, Ainsworth has a policy of leaving 3% of the standing volume as retention, such as a natural disturbance in the case of a fire would do, leaving green islands. That is what we try to do with a retention plan. In this area, what we've done is we've entered the blocks. Everything has been laid out prior to in the form of strips, and a feller buncher will leave the main road and will enter the block in a strip fashion, cutting everything directly in front of the buncher and then reaching into the stand to his sides and pulling out a percentage of the timber, protecting the understory and leaving about 33% of the standing deciduous behind.
Overall, though, the motivation would be something that would leave a lesser ecological footprint. Would you say that's the motivation behind it?
Oh, definitely. Well, in this stand type, the whole idea, of course, is to gather the volume or a percentage of the volume, and what you leave is definitely an ecological, I guess an improved ecological site or some ecological values behind remain on the stand as they were previously. And we're looking at what is the difference now after the stand has been harvested in the understory fashion as compared to what it was originally.
What other things are you looking at within the project?
Well, in the project, we have 12 sites that we're looking at, or 12 blocks we can call them. Three of the blocks are identical to this. They are blocks that originally had an aspen canopy with a spruce understory in them. We've harvested the three. We spread them out over the project area to ensure that we can look at the similarities and differences throughout, or we can capture the similarities. We also have three blocks that are similar to this, aspen overstories with conifer understories, that are control blocks, so we can go back, so we continue to measure those and we can do our comparisons between the cut and uncut. We also have three blocks that are clear-cut deciduous blocks. There was no spruce understory. And then we have three control blocks of the same. So we can compare the ecological basis in there, too, of a clear-cut versus a control over time, and how the ecological differences are the ecological basis of that block changes over time with new species coming in as the new forest begins to grow. And we're also comparing the ecological differences and similarities in the understory protected block versus the clear-cut block. So it is actually, it's a fairly widespread study, not only looking at the mixed wood, but also at the clear-cut, and we're looking at the comparisons there.
What's it like working with the scientific crew?
It's interesting. There's a, when I've been out several times with them, on the bird surveys especially, and there are a lot of things that that you see, or that you, well, when you're out with these researchers, things that they tell you, things that you see for yourself when you're with them, that you, that the general public or myself as a forester do not see. It's not things that you generally look for, such as with the mobbing calls. I've never seen that happen before, and it was very interesting. So it's, actually we have a great working relationship. I think they've learned a few things from us, and we're definitely learning things from them.
When you look at this from a management perspective, is it something that you think all companies could benefit from, having this relationship with the scientific community, looking more at the research aspects of what you're doing and incorporating that into your business planning?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the right now we're coming in a specific time frame. What we're leaving here, standing here, looking around us, is a great deal of timber left on site, a lot of structure. But what the big thing is how is that, what is going to happen to this area over time? And that is what we're trying to pinpoint now as we continue with this research project. That's going to be the real interesting focus here, is over time, how much of structure remains, what kind of wildlife are in it now, what kind of wildlife will start to come in the years to come.
That was Fred Radersma, the planning superintendent with Ainsworth Lumber Company near Grand Prairie. Scientists from the Alberta Research Council are looking at a variety of species in both the Grand Prairie and Manning forests, including bats, flying squirrels, and birds. Dr. Samantha Song is an avian ecologist with the Alberta Research Council. Samantha usually starts her day at the crack of dawn, walking deep into the woods to count birds in the research plots.
You can do a number of different types of surveys that all involve standing and listening. There's a point count survey where you stand at a point for 5 or 10 minutes. We've been doing a lot of spot mapping, which is you have a grid, like we have 10 hectare grids here, where you go and repeatedly survey these males and for singing, and then you can map out where their territories are, or there's line transect methods, but it's all walking, standing, listening.
In this project, Samantha is employing a new technique to census birds.
This is a homemade contraption. We're still working on perfecting the system, but it is a couple of Walkman-style speakers, or for a CD Walkman, that we've duct taped together, and that I'm just parking in the tree at about a meter, 1.2 meters in height, and then I'm going to string it up to a tape Walkman, and we can do the playback. What we've just played was the chickadee mobbing call, and the whole idea of it is to attract species in so that we can see them, and because most of the time when we're out surveying, you can't see them, and we just identify them by ear. Now, the point of seeing them is to get a more idea of whether they're actually reproducing in the stand or they're just hanging out. So are they getting mates? Are they having babies? And that sort of thing. And that's the importance for determining whether or not the population is actually viable. So when they come in, we can see if they have mates, and we can often see if they're feeding, if they have food in their mouths, which usually means they have fledglings and on the nest. Now, with the apparatus here, what this was playing was the chickadee mobbing call, and the birds respond very well to it because it cues into this mobbing behavior that they have, which is a response when there's a predator nearby, these sit-and-wait predators. When one of those are detected, they will often come in and start mobbing it, which is just calling and calling and calling and giving distress calls. And it is really a response that goes across species, and it's particularly distinct in for forest songbirds among chickadees. And so we can utilize that to bring the birds in.
Samantha describes our first stop as an 80-year-old mixed wood aspen stand with a sub-canopy of white spruce. There's been no logging. Our next stop is much different.
This one's been harvested in, using this understory protection method, and so it's far more open. There's a lot more light. I'm hearing a lot of species that are more associated with more with aspen or with open areas. Well, there's some pine sixlings that are flying around, and here's a black-capped chickadee right here coming. And there's its mate. So we got the pair now. You can see how aggressive they are. They're coming right up to the speaker, whereas the other birds are staying higher up in the canopy. Oh, there goes a couple pairs flying by. Didn't get a good look at those. These are two pine siskins. Here's a pair right up here. There's a raven in the background. And there's a Philadelphia vireo right overhead there. Beautiful. Heard him singing in the background, and there's a pair.
Were you in this area last year?
Yes, we were. We were in this forest before it was logged.
So what you're hearing now, how does that compare to what you heard last year before it was logged?
There's some more species here that are associated with open areas and more species that you'll hear with aspen when there's more light in the stand and more aspen species like this least flycatcher that we can hear in the background. I associate that more with stands that have some openings, some understories, like some tall shrubs like alder, and often, what would be a natural analog, like a open willow area with like an open bog, that sort of area.
How does the population of birds react when last year they were here and there were trees, and then they come back this year and there's not so many trees?
Generally, what we've found is that we get what's called a crowding effect, and it's a crowding effect because the birds come back to the area sort of with an expectation, if I can call it that, that there will be habitat here, and when it's gone, they will move into the adjacent forest. So there's a crowding because everyone moves into the same area, and it increases the density. In subsequent years, that will decrease as the birds redistribute themselves in the landscape. And they tend to come back to the same spot because in the fall, when they fledge from the nest and the juveniles are moving around, they move around on the landscape a lot and sort of get to know their neighborhood. And that gives them an idea of, okay, what's my habitat? Where do I live? And then in the next year, they'll come back. And there seems to be good site fidelity.
Our last stop is a stand of old-growth aspen that's 120 years old. What's noticeable here is the understory. It's mostly alder, with only the tiniest of spruce dotted here and there.
I think you hit the nail on the head by saying it's complex because I think we've made this huge leap by recognizing the value of mixedwoods, and now it's at the point where, you know, we have to try and characterize that a little bit. I mean, we've visited a few types of mixed wood stands today, but there's more out there, and that's one thing we're trying to get at, it that the stand or the land base isn't just about aspen stands and conifer stands or old growth white spruce stands. You can get a mix of varying heights of spruce and aspen mixed together, different amounts, and all that change in structure makes a huge difference on the songbird populations there. And so how do we manage that, and how do we emulate it or maintain it on the landscape is a really important challenge for us.
In the research that you've been doing, what have you found so far? What are some things that stand out for you?
Mainly the variation in the different types of mixed woods that are out there. And so when you have a pure aspen stand, the age of the stand is huge and the amount of conifer that's in. So you can have a really tiny underspruce underspruce, low understory of spruce that has a very different effect than if you're in an old growth aspen stand that has a very tall spruce component in it. You'll see something quite different. On that tape that you just made of the birds singing in this stand, you can hear there's two American redstarts countersinging quite, and maybe three they got on that tape because they're, you know, being quite territorial. And then in the background we heard this juvenile white-throated sparrow, and in, you know, this is getting towards the end of June here, and the fledglings are starting to come out, and that's actually the first juvenile that I have heard this year, and they are, you know, getting to know their surroundings and starting to practice what it's like to be a territorial white-throated sparrow. And so they're checking out their voices and developing it. And so instead of that beautiful "Oh sweet Canada, Canada" sound, you get that little wimpy whistle just going. And it, you know, it's one of those things. It's just an added bonus of working out here. It's quite charming.
That was Dr. Samantha Song of the Alberta Research Council. She's part of the Mixed Wood Biodiversity Project commissioned by Ainsworth Lumber and Manning Diversified Forest Products. After William Rowan died in the mid-1950s, R.B. Miller was asked to replace him as the chair of the zoology department at the University of Alberta. But his research career was cut all too short when 4 years later, on February 23, 1959, he succumbed to liver disease. As a top-notch researcher into fish biology, he often succeeded in convincing the provincial government to change its regulations to improve the lot of Alberta's fish. Among his notable accomplishments was the establishment of Alberta's first biological research station in 1950. One of his closest colleagues was Dr. Martin Pates, now a retired director of fisheries for the province of Alberta.
Yes, I was. I met Dr. Miller in 1950, and I was approached by him, as a matter of fact, my first year student at U of A, to take a summer position with him at the Gorge Creek Biological Station, as it became known. It was the first year it started. And I guess my association with him grew from there. It was almost more than a student-professor relationship. And it was a very happy one.
The biological station, why did he start it down at Gorge Creek?
Well, there was a lot of concern over the survival of hatchery trout. And he was, going along with the idea that they didn't do too well, because in a lot of places where the streams where they've been planted were just, they were just not successful. And so set up this station on a creek called Gorge Creek to determine precisely whether hatchery fish did survive well in the wild or not. And the station grew from there to accommodating other student research. I can think of a couple like blue grouse and ground squirrels, Columbia ground squirrels, and so on. But primarily it was there for fisheries research.
What was the problem, and why weren't these hatchery fish surviving?
Well, it took a while. It took several years of experiment, but certainly we determined that they weren't surviving well. And so he got a little bit deeper into the subject and found out that the hatchery fish, because of the way they'd been reared, were not acclimatized to the rigors of the wild streams. And he found that the lactic acid that was built up because of their use of their energy was such that it eventually caused a toxic problem with them, which they couldn't recover from.
What's some of the other work that he was known for in fish research?
Well, he had written a lot of papers in his relatively short scientific life, and the I guess the ones that stand out are the Trionophrys research or the Pike Whitefish tapeworm, which is at Lesser Slave Lake. And he did a number of things on the that family of tapeworms that were infesting fish. And he did some work for the federal government to determine whether the tapeworm cysts in the flesh of fish was in fact detrimental to their sales in the United States. That's where most of our whitefish are sold. And so they went around the western provinces, he and a couple of other fellows, and determined that, yes, there was a level of infestation which the market didn't appreciate. More of an aesthetic thing, because that particular tapeworm can complete its life cycle in man and therefore is harmless. But it's an aesthetic thing when they see these little tapeworm cysts in the flesh of whitefish. So the American market just naturally said, if there are more than these, they're this amount, we won't buy your fish. And so that was quite a big part of his work, too, on whitefish.
In the time that you were working with him as a researcher, what was he like to work with? How did he go about doing his research?
Well, he was very down-to-earth and very accommodating for inexperienced kids, I guess. But anyway, he was an excellent, I would call him a teacher rather than a lecturer, as some professors are known for. And he was very straightforward and just easy to get along with as a student-professor relationship. And having traveled with him throughout the province, it was, I guess I would say, a pleasure to work with a scientist of that caliber, just because of the way he handled things.
Can you think of any incident that stands out, either as a happy memory or just something that kind of epitomizes the way he was as a person?
Well, I think all my memories of him are quite happy memories. There are a number of little things that I guess stand out. He used to play the guitar and do a little bit of singing. And so down at the Gorge Creek Station, when we'd have a get-together, I guess you can call them a party, he would get out his guitar and do a little bit of singing and sort of lead the party along. He was quite adept at coming out with one-liners, for example. So his sense of humor was pretty good. But I guess most of all, I remember him as a coach during my university years, and even subsequently after I took a job with government, which he was instrumental in me getting. He was still a great person to go to for advice from time to time.
He wasn't the chairman of the zoology department for very long. What happened? Why did he die?
Well, he developed some sort of internal liver problems. And from the time that he developed those, as a matter of fact, he was his wife was, and so was he, from Eastern Canada. And he left for a visit to the east while we had the Gorge Creek Station going. And then he wrote a letter to me from down there and said, Martin, I have a health problem. Could you manage the station for me for the rest of the summer? And which I did, of course. But it progressed from there. He never really had periods of what you could call recovery from that condition. And so his the rest of his scientific life was very short and very unfortunately.
I've had an opportunity to look at some of the bound volumes of his reports, the very first one from the biological station when it was set up. They're all hand-typed out and have the actual photographs glued into the pages. And you can see how the area, how lush it was at the time. When you think back, this is like 40 years ago,
yeah.
Almost untouched in that area. And I understand that it was his wife who finished up the last of his reports.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the book, The Cool Curving World, which was partly scientific and just partly a literary thing, he passed away just before he had finished that. And I think his wife wrote the last chapter or thereabouts, perhaps a little bit more than that, on his last work at the biological station. And I think she also wrote part of the last chapter on just the way things were going as far as the environment was concerned. He had started that last chapter, but I think she completed it.
That was Dr. Martin Pates, retired director of fisheries for Alberta. He was reminiscing about the life of fish biologist Dr. R.B. Miller. Next week, Martin talks about his career as the first government fisheries biologist. This segment of Innovation Alberta was sponsored by the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can download past programs or listen to them on Real Audio. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.